Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. Our speaker tonight, Chris Hedges, you probably have heard of him. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He has a new book out with great title, America, The Farewell Tour. Chris Hedges, thank you very much for coming.
So all of the books that I write have, at least in my mind, a kind of template, a particular book that I look back on as a kind of model for what I want to do, what I want to investigate. I wrote a book a couple years ago with a great cartoonist, Joe Sacco, called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, where we went to the poorest pockets of the United States. I mean, literally, Camden, New Jersey, for example, per capita, the poorest city in America. Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, to write about sacrifice zones. Zones that had been sacrificed for profit and destroyed as the southern Appalachians have been destroyed, turned in, especially with mountaintop removal, into toxic wastelands. And I don't use the word lightly, the air, the water. We would go into the elementary schools, and in the nurse's office would be rows of little inhalers for the children. And the template for that book was Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee with a photography by Walker Evans. This book, the genesis of this book really comes out of Emile Durkheim's great work called Suicide, published in 1897. And Durkheim, like W.E.B. Du Bois, I think was a very important thinker and sociologist. Because they did not, both Du Bois and Durkheim did not sit in, cased in academic institutions, but were relentless about going out and interviewing and writing out of the experiences of the people that they were focusing upon, and the Philadelphia Negro, Souls of Black Folk. This was Du Bois's great genius. But this is what Durkheim did in Suicide. And he uncovered many things about the conditions that drive people towards self-annihilation that were quite novel and remain extremely important in terms of our own understanding of the forces of despair that propel an individual and a society towards what Freud would call the death instinct, thanatos, which is actually a post-Freudian term. And Durkheim, from his research, found that when there is no longer a balance between individual initiative and communal solidarity, that creates the highest rates of suicide. He called it a life-sustaining equilibrium between the personal and the collective. These are the social bonds that lie below the surface of any society, but inform our own consciousness and our own perception of ourselves. And the term that he used, anomie, to describe what it is that propelled people towards self-destructive behavior literally means rulelessness. And like James Baldwin, who made the same point in his essays, he found that those on the lowest end of the economic spectrum, in the case of Baldwin, African Americans have lower rates of suicide. And Baldwin argues, I think correctly, in the same way that Durkheim does, that the reason is that within African American society, the traditionally white supremacy has stacked the deck against African Americans, and they're cognizant of that. Whereas, as Baldwin writes, he said, "Why is it that those who have a midlife crisis are primarily white men? It's because they believe the myth of the meritocracy and the American dream." And this is very much Durkheim's point, that that those who are oppressed already understand that the rules are stacked against them. He made a couple, I think, very important observations for our own society. He said that when you experience an economic meltdown, when a society fails, suicide rates rise for those who were prosperous before the economic decline or economic failure. And he also noted, interestingly, that suicide is rates rise for those who are propelled upwards in a moment of prosperity beyond their own social class. Those who have actually social mobility and achieve significant wealth and even power, that it is disorienting and can often be a very effective force in severing the social bonds that Durkheim argues leads to the anomie and the suicide. Durkheim understood that in a capitalist society, it's a transactional, there's a primacy of transactional relationships, not real or sustained relationships, that to prosper and succeed within the system of capitalism is antithetical to building communal solidarity, to building real relationships with other people. And that those who are elevated and advance within a capitalist system do so by building temporary, but he would argue false and hollow and ultimately empty relationships. Because to succeed within the capitalist system, you have to have within you and express qualities or abilities of manipulation, a lack of empathy or remorse, narcissism about your own advancement, both materially and in terms of power at the expense of other people. And and this creates a kind of frightening pathology, even a kind of psychopathic mentality, which is why a society as ours is, that embraces unfettered and unregulated capitalism, that allows the marketplace under the ideology of neoliberalism or globalization to determine how we structure our society, has such a profound effect on our own emotional and psychological well-being. So, for those of you who know Marx, this is a very different concept between Durkheim and Marx, because Marx wrote about alienation as a positive force, that alienated workers would begin to question their own, the abusive structure of capitalism. And this alienation would lead them to reassess those oppressive structures leading to resistance and revolt. So Durkheim takes a very a completely different tact. And he argues that anomie, he writes that many of those who are consumed by this anomie are quite cognizant of what's happening around them. But the anomie sucks all of the energy out of them, and it doesn't, unlike Marx, it doesn't strengthen the will, but weakens and destroys it. Durkheim also, I think, pinpoints within a healthy society the importance of ritual. And he said that that is the elementary form of social cohesion. And when ritual, religious or otherwise, is eviscerated by a secular society, when nothing has an intrinsic value, when you lose the capacity for the sacred, then you build a system where everything is exploited until exhaustion or collapse. And, of course, this is precisely what is happening within our corporate state with the climate, with the biosphere. The primacy of short-term economic profit is elevated above the very ability of the human species to sustain itself in a degraded environment. Durkheim wrote, "Our actions require an object outside themselves. It is not because we need to sustain the illusion of some impossible immortality. It is because it is implicit in our moral being, and it cannot be lost, even partially, without that moral being losing its reason for existence. There is no need to demonstrate that in such a state of collapse, the slightest cause for depression can easily give rise to desperate acts. When life is not worth living, everything becomes a pretext for ridding ourselves of it. For individuals are too closely involved in the life of society for it to be sick without their being affected. Its suffering inevitably becomes theirs." That was the foundation of this book that I have spent 2 years writing. It came out of Durkheim's understanding that when a society is sick, it produces self-destructive pathologies that are driven by this anomie. And every civilization in decline suffers precisely from this dislocation, this alienation. I studied classics at Harvard, and the end of the Roman Empire, as Tacitus and Cicero understood, and Gibbon as well, was characterized by a series of self-destructive pathologies, including sexual sadism, the breakdown of the open society. We can argue whether Rome was ever truly a democracy. The way Greece was, probably not. But certainly before the Civil War and the rise of Augustus, the Republic had some semblance of representative democracy. Increasingly, at the end of the Roman Empire, these were just facades. And I would argue the same way that electoral politics, the courts, I mean, we have just watched hearings for a Supreme Court justice who, I think at this point, it has been quite well documented, is a serial liar, just like the person in the Oval Office. And this is characteristic of societies that decline. Trump becomes not the problem or the disease, but Trump is the symptom. Trump is the expression. Indeed, he is in a society obsessed with celebrity and narcissism and self-promotion, which is what Facebook is about. It's not about friendship. It's about, as Neil Gabler writes, life, the movie, presentation. And it's the opposite of friendship. Because friendship is the relationship with another who tells you unpleasant truths about yourselves to make you a better person, who cares enough about helping you examine your own self, and which is always painful. And of course, if all of us are honest, we have maybe two or three friends, true friends, and some of us have none. And in a society that is increasingly atomized and entranced by these electronic hallucinations, it destroys the fabric of the real relationships that go into making us healthy and whole human beings. So Trump, whose his record as a business person is one mitigated disaster after another. It's why, at least from what I can tell from the Mueller investigation, what they're focusing on is not actually Russian manipulation of the election, but the close connection that the failing Trump industry as a developer had with Russian oligarchs and the Russian mafia through Cypriot banks. It seems pretty clear that there was heavy money laundering and fraud in order to sustain him. Trump went through numerous bankruptcies. He regularly defrauded his investors and refused to pay his contractors, many of whom went into bankruptcy because of it. And so you take this person who is certainly an inept, corrupt, and one could even argue failed business person, and you present him on television in The Apprentice as a titan of the universe. It's the fictional personality, created personality, as all of our political figures are now created personalities. And the public relations industry, which, you know, one could argue is one of the most evil industries in America, is quite good at making us feel a certain way. Remember the presidential race between Gore and Bush, and supposedly we would vote for Bush because he's the person we wanted to have a beer with. These are all fictional creations, manufactured personalities, and they're manufactured to make us confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. And that's what Trump is, a creation of that media universe of NBC and Zucker, who has moved to CNN and continued the reality show on a 24-hour news cycle with great profit, of course, eviscerating journalism. There's very little journalism. It's all, even this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, it's the gossip of courtiers in the court. While 70% of this country lives in pretty severe distress and have been rendered utterly invisible. And so Trump is an expression of the decayed culture. He is the natural result of a system that is seized up, that has been seized by corporate power. What Sheldon Wolin, taught at Berkeley and later Princeton, called our system of inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It continues to, like the late Roman Republic, pay fealty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, but internally corporations, K Street, but in every state capital it's the same, have seized the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And when a cabal seizes power. And in late Rome, it was the ruling families. I don't know if there are any classicists here, but I once decided that I would call the local bookstore, which I did in Princeton, very good bookstore, Labyrinth, and convince them to let them host a reading by Gaius Valerius Catullus, which they did, which was me. And I decided that I would read the 26 poems, they're called the Lesbia poems, which he wrote to his lover, who was married, who came from one of the ruling families, Claudia Pulcher. And it goes from, stars in his eyes, and she betrays him. And in the end, it's quite graphic descriptions of her depravity, kneeling in alleys to service elderly men. He's writing this stuff. So, and I got my wife, who went to Juilliard and is an actor, and we said translation by Claudia Pulcher, which was, of course, an inside classicist joke. And the local paper actually called and asked if they could interview Gaius Valerius Catullus before the reading. And I was just, but too steeped in years at the New York Times to pull that one off, although I was very tempted. And we got in I thought no one would come. I actually bought a toga, which I thought, why not go all out, you know? So I had like this cheap toga. I mean, it was ridiculous, but, and I read the poems in Latin. And then my wife, as Claudia, read she also had a toga. Well, we thought, no, we did it for ourselves. We thought we'd get three people. Well, it turns out every high school Latin student had come. And those last poems were not taught in high school. So, a little aside. That's what I do to keep sane. So, but Trump is a product of that system. Trump is, he's a con artist, and his power, of course, like all demagogues or con artists, is that he tells people what he wants to hear. But more importantly, he ridicules with his vulgarity the elites, both Democratic and Republican, that have betrayed most of the country. And the longer the press continues to think that Stormy Daniels or Stormy Daniels' lawyer who's going to run for president, or Omarosa is news, the longer they render those people and their suffering unseen, the more that vulgarity and incitement to violence and bigotry and racism becomes in some perverted way cathartic. I wrote a book a few years ago on the Christian right called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. I was trying to reach out to them. And I didn't use the word fascist lightly. In fact, when I finished the book, I went to Fritz Stern, the great scholar on German fascism, who grew up in Nazi Germany, escaped when he was 18, who wrote The Politics of Cultural Despair. And then I sat down with Robert Paxton, who wrote Anatomy of Fascism, the great Vichy scholar at Columbia. And I truly saw that movement as fascist. And I speak as a seminary graduate. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. My father was a Presbyterian minister. I grew up in the church. But they had joined the language and symbols of the Christian religion with those of the state. They had sacralized the worst elements of American imperialism and American capitalism, and they sell the magical thinking, which, as Hannah Arendt points out, is always a hallmark of totalitarian movements. Magic Jesus. And the embrace of a non-reality-based worldview, creationism. I was in the Creationist Museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, with groups of visitors. The first diorama is the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are plastic figures, naked, but Eve, you can't see anything. You can't see Eve's breasts. She's hidden in the waterfall. And the T-Rex, which has a saddle on it. Because 6 days was all created. And the guide is telling this group, well, I know you all wonder why T-Rex has such big teeth. It's because Adam and Eve used T-Rex to open the coconuts. Now, here it's kind of funny, but when you're standing with 50 people who believe it, it's truly terrifying.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And that danger of magical thinking, anthropologists call it crisis cults. We saw it, a society in terminal decay inevitably embraces crisis cults because the real world, the walls of the real world, the bleakness of the real world is too much to bear. So 1890, Wounded Knee, the ghost dance, wearing shirts which will stop the bullets, the belief that this Sufi-like dance would bring back the buffalo herds and the great warriors who had been killed would rise up from the earth and the white man would disappear. And every society, when pushed to extreme, when they can't cope, and there's that great book by Cohen on millennialism in the 15th century in Europe, that's you can't surmount that. I can't. At the end of that book on the Christian right, I came to the conclusion we can't argue these people out of this. The only way is to reintegrate them into the economy in a meaningful way, which, of course, the opposite has happened. We've concentrated wealth into the hands of oligarchs and created social inequality that is even greater than the so-called Gilded Age. And so that book, the book I wrote, I'm with heroin addicts, gamblers I actually wrote my gambling chapter out of the Trump Taj Mahal before Trump announced that he was going to run for president. And it was just a kind of metaphor. I mean, gamblers, most people gamble on slots. They sit there for hours and hours and hours. They're completely addicted. Gambling addicts have the highest rates of attempted suicide of any addict. They lose their health. They lose their family. They lose their job. They lose their home. And those who design these slot machines, there's a good book on it, Addicted by Design, by Professor Shull, know fully well what they're doing. And this is the industry Trump comes out of. So when I'm in the Taj, it's at the end of its life. It's gone bankrupt several times. Most of the rooms are mothballed. There's mold and stains in the ceiling. The lights are burned out. In the bathrooms, there's plastic bags over the urinals and toilets that say out of order. Heroin addicts are shooting up in the elevator. There are literally rodents, mice and rats running across the dining rooms. And it's a kind of metaphor for where a figure like Trump takes you. But until we address the causes of the enemy, until we confront the grotesque social inequality, the hopelessness, and the despair, we even if Trump is impeached, and Noam Chomsky argues Pence is worse, well, because Trump actually has no ideology. He's not capable of an ideology. Trump, the ideological void or vacuum around Trump is being filled by the Christian right. He just had 100 pastors, evangelical pastors in the White House. And I wanted to say in this book, you better look at the consequences of human suffering. And the figures are there, but the stories are more important. Casino industries, which have expanded now across the country, everywhere. The whole idea that building casinos is a form of economic development. They tried that in Yugoslavia when I was there. I covered the war there. When the economy broke down, and it didn't work out very well. In fact, with the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, and we are headed for another collapse. I mean, the New York Times last week ran a very chilling editorial, and they ran an article in the Sunday Book Review a week ago talking about the fracking industry as the next dot-com bubble, because, in fact, the frackers aren't making any money, and Wall Street's pumping all this money they've looted from the U.S. Treasury at 0% interest into the fracking industry on projected profits the same way they did with the dot-com. So if when that comes, I mean, we live in a period of relative stability, but when that stability is gone, and I saw this in Yugoslavia, then the monsters come out. Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman, or go back to Weimar. I mean, the Nazis in 1928 were polling in the single digits. And as the great historians of Nazi Germany, Evans, Kershaw's great biography of Hitler, point out, without that depression, Hitler wouldn't have ever achieved political power. Because the 1929 crash comes, and Ebert and the Social Democrats decide to satisfy the demands of the global banking system and impose punishing austerity on the German people, including severing unemployment insurance. The Nazis were as buffoonish as Trump and the cretins like Stephen Miller or Bannon or any of the others. But the rage at an elite that has betrayed you, both Republican and Democrat, and the fact that your suffering and your voices are not heard. I mean, I travel, I think I reported from 10 or 11 states, Utah, Indiana, Illinois, Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I opened, where the city's going in bankruptcy. And when societies break down, I was in Anderson, Indiana. Anderson used to be one of the great big centers for GM, 25,000 workers in the city, had good UAW union jobs, $25, $30 an hour, pensions, benefits. They could buy a house. They could send their children to college. They could support a family on one salary. Clinton passes NAFTA. Those plants are in Monterrey, Mexico, where Mexican workers are making $3 an hour with no benefits. The town's a wreck. The life's been sucked out of it. The plants were bulldozed, so there's gigantic weed-choked lots. And I was with old UAW workers. They can't even drive by them. Everything boarded up, abandoned streets. And then what happens? Suicide, alcoholism, opioid, the opioid crisis. All these, as Durkheim understood, these self-destructive forces that are created by a society in deep distress. And go back and read Cicero. Read what Cicero wrote about the arena. That as Rome, the Roman Empire, declined and became degenerate, the spectacles got larger and larger, and totalitarian societies do spectacle very well. 40,000 people investing just in the Colosseum in the tawdry, the salacious, the violent. The elevation of figures like Nero, Caligula, Commodus, who's kind of a lot like Trump, Commodus, if you know anything about him, had no interest in governing. It was all presentation. And in the end, the Civil War starts, and Mark Antony, who was kind of cleaned up by Shakespeare, orders Cicero hunted down, and he's decapitated, and his hands are cut off, and his head and hands are brought into the arena, and it's announced that he'll never speak or write again, and 40,000 people cheer. And so I've been accused of being bleak, but that's not the point. The point is understanding what's in front of us. The mania for hope is really infantile. Just climate change alone should terrify all of us. We have very little time left. And unless we understand what it is, the disease that is eating away at the American empire, as long as we mask it over with trivia and gossip and entertainment, the more malignant that disease becomes. It does us no good by denying it its existence. And it's, you know, the chapter on sexual sadism was written out of kink.com. Hopefully no one knows what that is here. But I took classes in the armory, which were appalling. It was me in a basement with a bunch of dweeby guys dressed in black. It's torture. They even use the word torture. And that sexual depravity is also a characteristic of a society where human beings and everything becomes objects to exploit and to fill a perverted and heartless form of human exchange. That's where you end up. The late Austro-Hungarian Empire was no different. Empires, as Joseph Tainter in The Collapse of Complex Societies has pointed out, bear similar characteristics when they go down. And I think for me, and this is, I somehow magically got on 5 minutes on MSNBC, but this is just not a message that commercial airwaves and commercial entities want heard, because it's negative or it's true. And it is vitally important if we are going to not only endure as a nation, but endure as a species, that we confront this truth in all its bleakness. And that may be the greatest existential struggle of our time. Because after confronting it, we must resist. And you have heroic resistors in this city right now, 30,000 of whom were marching through the streets of San Francisco to protest the ecocide that's being carried out for short-term profit. We must resist, finally, as a moral imperative. And I have 4 children. Even if we fail, those who come after us, I want those who come after to at least say, he tried. Because to be passive at a moment like this is to be complicit in what Immanuel Kant called radical evil. Thank you.
So I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Chris Hedges speaking about his book, America, the Farewell Tour. It's time for questions. I'd like to start with one. You said that this was a little bit of a bleak vision. I've heard bleaker. And what those ask the question, if we've done such a bad job, would it not be a blessing for the human race to not endure?
Well, I mean, the universe is morally neutral. Or I saw you, you've read Homer.
Yeah.
That's Homer's power, in that he understood that the gods are with you one day and have sold you out the next. So the universe is more, I don't put a moral, I mean, the planet will go on. We have built human civilization, has existed only for 10,000 years, the end of the last ice age. The peculiar climate conditions, the Gulf Stream, have not always been part of Earth, which has been estimated 4.5 billion years old. So, and there's that whole theory that the reason we have never encountered quote-unquote intelligent life in the universe is because when you reach this level of technology, you are expending so much energy that was stored in terms of coal and fossil fuels, petroleum, that you extinguish yourself. I mean, this is Carl Sagan and others. So I wouldn't say morally whether we exist or not. That's not a moral issue, but I happen to have a kind of fondness for the human race. I'm a member of it. And I think as a parent, I live in fear because when they talk about climate change, they say 2100. Well, this is really not an appropriate figure because it's already happening, as you know, with the wildfires, and we now have Hurricane Florence. I mean, these monster storms. But what it does is it's beyond most of our lifetimes. So the human species, I think there's kind of an evolutionary blind spot where we just don't see beyond our own lifetime. So I've seen the worst. I covered the war in Bosnia. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. I've seen human atrocity and what human beings are capable of. I think I was kind of well prepared as a Presbyterian seminarian because I read a lot of Calvin. It was a pretty dark view of human nature, which I share. And yet at the same time, I think there's an understanding that there are forces, Freud calls them Eros and Thanatos, there are battles between life and death, between love and death. And you could feel it in the war, in Sarajevo, when the shells, these heavy shells, 155 howitzers, 90 millimeter tank rounds would come in, and there was no water service in Sarajevo. People to get water had to go to collection points, and the Serb gunners would target those collection points. So as whatever pictures you ever saw from the war in Sarajevo were nothing compared to what it was like to be there. They were heavily censored photographs or video. And you could feel the concentric circles of love and death, because there was a lot of death, and yet there were also those family members. I mean, it was palpable. It was real. And I think that, especially for somebody who comes out of a religious tradition, it is our role as human beings to choose what we are going to fight for. And that battle between, if you want to call it good and evil, will always exist. But we live in a... And Freud wrote that it's not just individuals who embrace the death instinct, but societies. And that's what civilization and its discontents is about. And we have a moral, ethical responsibility to stand up and fight for life, even if we fail. Because that act of resistance, Camus writes this, becomes maybe the only freedom we have. But it is freedom. You know, there's a... Sartre was trying to convince a friend of his... I'm not a fan of Sartre, but Sartre was trying to convince a friend of his not to go back to Spain at the end of the Spanish Civil War because it was clear now that the Republicans were going to lose. And his friend said, "I don't fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And that, for me, has a religious sensibility, an ethical and moral sensibility. We have to stop it asking ourselves if we can win. Because if we don't resist, we can't use the word hope.
I had a feeling that behind the moral imperative passion that you expressed, that there was a vein of optimism underneath the bleakness. I think that was, that's great. Okay, next, first question.
I'm just trying to get my head around the feeling behind confront and resist as opposed to reimagine and recommit. And it seems to me like the legacy of the 60s, which was confront and resist, brought us 40 years of right-wing mentality, and we are at risk of making exactly the same mistake. It seems like we need to just decide that we know what we need to do, and we're going to commit to doing it. Now, that doesn't mean we don't resist, but it means that confronting and resisting by itself seems to be a very ultimately demobilizing strategy.
Okay, I mean, so I was a boy in the 60s, but my father was a civil rights anti-war activist. He'd actually been a sergeant in North Africa. He was a veteran in World War II. So I was there, I was a kid. In fact, the 60s were quite effective. The great failing of the 60s was that by that time, labor had, they weren't the longshoremen of 1934. They were the AFL-CIO under George Meany, who was supporting Nixon's war in Indochina and denouncing the hippies in the street. Because they had done, in the Red Scare, McCarthy, they destroyed the union, the radical unions, the Wobblies, the old CIO. So, but the 60s actually frightened the power elites tremendously. Heather Thompson wrote a book called Blood in the Water, which I highly recommend. On the Attica uprising, it's not only a brilliant history, but it also explains how frightened the elites were and their response, and that the Attica uprising really created this system of demonizing black men. But in the 1960s produced Richard Nixon, who was our last liberal president, not because he had a conscience or he was a liberal, or because he was frightened of movements. And there's that moment in Kissinger's memoirs. Don't buy the book. Don't buy it. But there, it's 1971. There's tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators around the White House. Nixon has taken empty city buses around the White House. And he's standing at the window going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. Well, that's where we want people in power to be. That is the check that we have against power. Roosevelt was terrified of revolution. He writes about it. I mean, he was an oligarch, steeped in it. And he's writing to his fellow oligarchs and says, we better give up some of our money or we're going to lose all of it. But we've lost those pressure, the old Communist Party. And I'm not a communist, but we have erased them from our history. And they were a potent and powerful force. There was a reason Du Bois was a communist. There was a reason Paul Robeson was a communist. Because you couldn't go anywhere else as a black radical. The Communist Party was doing integrating lunch counters. Ruskin, who came out of it, those tactics were copied from the Communist Party. We have lost those movements. We have no ability to pit power against power. And so power is eviscerating our country, stripping us of our rights. I was just up in Menlo Park, and Google and Facebook and Twitter, who's here, these people are not only have taken from us, along with security and surveillance state, our privacy, but built huge profiles of us and handed them to the state. And as Hanahan understood, the reason a totalitarian system builds files on every citizen is not because they're looking for crime. It's because the moment they seek to criminalize an individual or a group, there's something in there to justify it. I mean, the whole overturning of our constitutional rights by judicial fiat. So the Supreme Court rules that unlimited corporate and dark money is the right to petition the government or a form of free speech. They've utterly inverted. And so there were many problems with the 60s. You know, my father, because he came out of, he was with the Berrigans, he came out of Concerned Clergy and Laity. So, I mean, there was no alcohol in the house where I grew up. He hated the drugs. I actually think the drugs were a very pernicious part of the 60s. But what happened? 1971, Lewis Powell writes, the attack on the free enterprise system, and corporations can't pump enough money into the system to fight back against what Samuel Huntington called the excess of democracy. And in that memo, they name Ralph Nader as somebody they have to destroy, and they did, at least in his public image. So that uprising, and remember, it wasn't just the anti-war movement. We had the women's rights, Earth Day, which was organized by Ralph, the first Earth Day. And they destroyed our institutions, they destroyed our press, they destroyed academia. And so it has been a 40-some year assault. And they vomited up these faux liberals like Bill Clinton. I mean, the idea that Clinton, I mean, the Democratic Party, I've lived in Europe. The Democratic Party in Europe would be a far-right party. Seriously. I mean, there is not a weapon system they don't love. In terms of constitutional, I mean, just you can tick off the list. There's complete continuity. There was complete continuity between Bush and Obama on all the major issues. I mean, you have a kind of more enlightened, Ivy League educated wing of the billionaire class that doesn't want to be overtly racist and homophobic. And then you have the cretins on the other end of the billionaire class, like Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers, who don't care. But those aren't political issues. They're cultural. They're social. That's anti-politics. And that paralysis, that direction, that use of institutions, which should, as Karl Popper says, make piecemeal and incremental reform possible, which have been seized up so that everything is directed towards the further enrichment and empowerment of this corporate cabal. I mean, you cannot vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs in America. You can't. Even Trump's got five of them. And these people committed massive fraud. We know it. It's on the record. And so there was a reaction to the 60s, and they were quite effective. I mean, I've taught at Princeton. That's a corporation. Half of those people on that trustee board should be in prison. And you know, they get a lot of money. I went to graduate school at Harvard. They got, I don't even know why they need more money. I got an email from the president of Harvard. I mean, not personally. It was obviously a group email. And because they had a new capital campaign for $6 billion. I had to read it. $6 billion? And they got it. They got all that money, but it's killing critical thought. The richer they get, the more those voices that are going to offend those donors get shut out. And it's a kind of dumbing down of American education. So, first of all, we got to go back to the 60s because it had great music. We all have to admit. But we've got to rebuild those movements. I mean, I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I covered the Stasi. I covered the fall of East Germany. 500,000 East Germans in Alexanderplatz. That was it. I covered the Velvet Revolution. I was in the Magic Lantern Theater every night with Václav Havel. That's what we got to do through nonviolence. I have been very critical of the Antifa and the Black Bloc, and they will protest me and probably will when I go to Berkeley, and they all dressed in black and they carry all carry signs that say exactly the same thing, which is F you, Chris Hedges, which shows you the level of political thought embraced by Antifa and the Black Bloc. We, you know, that's it. And we have no time left. And I look at those movements. I was arrested in front of the White House with 133 veterans supporting the war. It was very moving. For me, that's my church. That's my ritual. That's where I get my sustenance. That's what keeps me going. And, you know, we got to turn off those machines. Sitting alone on your Facebook page writing a diatribe about Trump, you're sitting just where the corporate state wants you to be, which is sitting alone in your room in front of a screen. There's only one way to build relationships, and it's not electronically. And we have to build relationships with people whose views we find difficult, even repugnant. Because they are suffering. Whatever you say about the right wing, and I write in the book about, these white hate groups. I spend a lot of time with Proud Boys, Knights of the Alt-Right, Three Percenters. I was up actually in upstate New York, outside of Binghamton, in a rural area at night around a bonfire with these guys, praying to my Presbyterian God that none of them would Google me. But we have to hear there, you know, even that book for the Christian right, that first chapter is despair, because I just heard these stories of struggles with addictions and attempted suicides and sexual assault and domestic abuse and bankruptcy. You can't, if that doesn't break your heart, you don't have a heart. I look at the ideology as dangerous. These mega pastors do just what Trump does, which is prey on the despair of others for their own personal profit. But we do have to reach out with an empathy and an understanding, even to people who are not like us. However distorted and perverted their response is. And what was fascinating about that book is I was always very upfront about where I came from. I came out of liberal church. But because I listened, and because it was clear that I cared, even after the book was published, I maintained, not with the leaders, because I affirmed their own suffering and their own dignity. And the time is now. We have no time. There is no time to sit around and wonder whether Chuck Schumer is going to save us, because he isn't. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, these are all creatures of the corporate system. Their power comes by funneling Wall Street money to the anointed Democratic candidates. And if we had real electoral reform and we abolished corporate money, they wouldn't exist politically. And they know it. And however rotten the ship of state is, they've decided they're not giving up their first-class cabins. And it's dangerous. The whole notion that the Democrats will come to power by just letting Trump implode, the Clinton campaign tried that already. In fact, you read the Podesta emails, it's clear they wanted Trump as the candidate. And it's not a secret, I'm a socialist. Why? Because I don't think our mentally ill people should be left on sidewalks. Or 25% of whom are in a prison. I teach in a prison. I'm a socialist because I don't think 16 million children in this country should go to bed every night hungry. I'm a socialist because I think everybody has a right to a high-quality education free, including a university education. I'm a socialist because I believe that when people can't earn a sustainable wage, and this goes back to the New Deal, they should be given a wage. I'm a socialist because I don't think elderly people should be driving around in RVs working 12 hours on the night shift for Bezos, who's the richest man in the world. I'm a socialist because I saw the evil of empire. And I know that we have to dismantle this military machine. 17 years of warfare in Afghanistan, and what do we have to show for it? Nothing. The Taliban controls more of Afghanistan than they did when we went in. Why are we there? Because Raytheon, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman are making a killing. It's the greatest strategic blunder in American history, what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's called micromilitarism. It's what the Greeks did when they invaded Sicily. Entire fleet was sunk. Thousands of their soldiers were killed. The empire went belly up. It's what the British did when they tried to retake the Suez Canal after Nasser nationalized it in 1956. They had to retreat in humiliation. And what killed the British Empire will kill us the moment the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. Look what happened to the British economy when the British pound sterling was no longer the reserve currency. And this time around, you know, when it goes down, they don't have a plan B. They can't lower interest rates anymore, and they've already lowered them, which is basically zero. In fact, you can borrow money at 0% if you're Goldman Sachs and buy treasury bonds and get interest. I mean, I don't even know what you call a system like that. Maybe extortion. $26 trillion of fabricated money out of electronic ether. And what'd they do with it? They bought back their own stock, partly also the stack cuts, because their compensation packages are tied to it. They paid off unsustainable debts. They invested it in financial bubbles like the fracking industry, and they imposed debt peonage on us. Because they may have borrowed at 0%, but it still has to be paid back. And that's why when you're late on your credit card, it goes up to 28%. And that's why students have $1.5 trillion worth of student loan debt, which they can never get rid of, even if they declare bankruptcy. Thank you, our Congress, for that. $13.2 or $6 billion in household debt. But that's not a sustainable economic system. A system built on the scaffolding of debt, what Marx called fictitious capital. So it's all coming. Climate change, the rise of demagogues, the collapse of the currency, and it's going to be far, far worse if we pretend it's not happening. Because at least, however bleak the diagnosis is, at least we can begin to prepare. And part of that preparation has to be massive resistance against the global ruling elites who have decided that their amassing of obscene amounts of wealth is more important than human life.
Thank you very much. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club. It's 117th year of enlightened discussion. You're available to sign books?
Certainly.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much for coming.